Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the story of Custer's last stand reach American audiences, and how did the treatment of those news reports compare with the kind of coverage available to Americans today following our involvement in modern-day conflicts? Although Custer's legend was essentially undiminished, his final action as a military commander proved disastrous to U.S. Army forces in the Great Sioux War. And my guest today will explain the ways that reporting of that conflict are good lenses through which to examine contemporary journalism and its treatment of the war on terror and conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. James E. Mueller is professor of journalism at the University of North Texas. His new book is called Shooting Arrows and Slinging Mud, Custer, the Press, and the Little Bighorn. Jim, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So will you start by reminding us what was at stake in the Great Sioux War and who the major players were?
Well, the war had an economic beginning. Gold had been discovered in the Black Hills. The Black Hills were ceded by treaty to the Lakota tribe. But when gold was discovered there, the government could not keep miners out. And also there was an economic panic at the time, what we would call a recession. And so there was a lot of pressure to let miners in there also to help the economy and give people something to do. And so the government decided basically to kind of arrange a war. And Ulysses Grant, who was the president at the time, had his administration tell the Lakota and the Cheyenne, who were not on the reservation, they were out hunting or camping in the winter, to come in to the reservation or they'd be declared hostile. Since it was the middle of winter, most of them couldn't do it. It would have been suicidal anyway to leave their camps. And so by default, the government declared a war and then drew up a military campaign involving three columns to approach from three directions. And George Armstrong Custer was the second in command of a column that left from Fort Abraham Lincoln in the Dakota Territory to try to surround what were declared the hostile tribes, including Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, and then drive them to the reservation.
And he already had quite a reputation, not just within the military, but he was, if not a household name, he was known to American newspaper readers.
Oh, yes. He was a really famous person. He was a writer himself. He'd written a best-selling book called My Life on the Plains. He'd been one of the great heroes of the Civil War. He had always seemed to be in the right place at the right time. When the Grand Duke Alexis came to visit the United States from Russia, Custer was assigned to guide him on a hunting trip on the plains, and that drew a lot of press coverage. So he was quite well known and had been in the press for a long period of time dating back to the Civil War.
How interested was Custer in cultivating his own public reputation, and what did he do about that?
He was a very savvy person in terms of the press. I think today we would call him kind of a media guy. I think if he was alive today, he'd have his own Twitter account and a Facebook page and everything else. He was quite a self-promoter. One of the things he did during the Civil War was design his own uniform, which had a wide sombrero, floppy hat, a red tie that stood out, and all his men eventually adopted the red tie as kind of a symbol of their unity. And his long hair and his general charisma attracted a lot of press attention. And he, like a lot of other generals at that time, military men, would cultivate reporters and give them stories and so forth because it was a way to get promoted if you got attention for yourself. And so he was constantly doing things like that and writing articles and so forth that would draw attention to him.
And there was, in fact, an AP reporter, I don't know if embedded would be the right word, but along for observation in 1876.
Yeah, there was one reporter that went with Custer's column, a guy named Mark Kellogg. And actually, Custer had been told not to take a reporter, but he took him anyway. And also, Custer himself wrote some stories for newspapers anonymously while he was on the campaign, which was a standard practice at the time. A lot of military officers would send anonymous stories to the newspapers back east. But yeah, Mark Kellogg was a reporter who went with Custer and was sending dispatches back. Ironically, most of the reporters went with another column under the command of a general named George Crook because most of the editors felt that was where the real action was going to be.
Hmm. How were they getting that word back? I mean, there was telegraph technology. Talk a little bit about how the process worked and what sort of delay there was from the occurrence of an event to, you know, making the front pages of papers everywhere.
Well, it was really difficult if you were on a campaign in Montana, Wyoming, away from telegraph lines, because they would simply have to have a runner or a scout physically carry the dispatches to a city that would have a telegraph. Once it was at a city with a telegraph, then the news could be communicated almost instantaneously, but, you know, unless there were breaks in the line or something like that. But what happened at the Little Bighorn itself was that they were so far in the wilderness and it took so long to get a courier back to the telegraph at Bismarck, Dakota Territory, that it took several days. The battle was June 25th. They found Custer and his men on the 26th, and then it wasn't reported into most newspapers until July 6th.
So, Jim, there is much to be ashamed of in the way this country treated its native inhabitants and sort of claimed their land for its own when it turned out to have gold on it or, you know, good arable land or whatever. But one thing that might surprise people is that there was a robust debate over the appropriateness of American policy with regard to Native tribes.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really surprised me when I did the research, because I expected to find a lot of headlines saying exterminate the savages and that kind of thing. And there was that kind of coverage. But there was also a real debate about, number one, who started the war. And I would say the majority of newspaper editorial pages recognized that the government was at fault. And a lot of newspaper editorialists and journalists also argued that you couldn't call it a massacre. Some people called it the Custer Massacre, but others were saying, hey, this is a war. The native tribes were defending themselves. This was no more a massacre than some of the battles during the Civil War. And, you know, speaking of the Civil War, everyone at the time was really looking to the Civil War as kind of a way to view the current fighting in 1876. Mm-hmm. It was only 10, 11 years removed. And the Civil War press used a lot of terms like savages, extermination, and kind of things to talk about Union soldiers and Confederate soldiers. And so to use that kind of rhetorical hyperbole, extermination and so forth, was kind of a carryover from the Civil War press. But usually they didn't mean it in terms of things like we would think today, genocide or something like that, terms that we kind of throw around loosely. But again, at the time in 1876, some newspapers were arguing for what would then be radical solutions to the Native American conflict, granting Native American citizenship. There was one newspaper in Chicago that advocated gun control. Let's just take their guns away like they do in some towns in Kansas, they argued, in the Wild West. And if white men have to surrender their guns, make the Natives surrender their guns and then we'll solve the problem. And if they misbehave, we'll, you know, prosecute them like we do white people. And so in that sense, it's kind of a little bit like the current debate, what do we do with terrorists? Do we treat them as military prisoners or do we prosecute them in court? So that debate actually is, you know, more than 100 years old.
And depending on where you were in the country, there were individuals in 1876 who might have had direct experience with moving into territories that were disputed, that had belonged to Native tribes before. How did that affect the way that different parts of the country and different newspapers covered the story, perceived the story?
Well, I think as you got closer to the frontier, there was less sympathy for the Native peoples. For example, in the Texas press, one editorial said, call for volunteers from Texas. Give Texans a show at the Sioux and we'll teach them, you know, what's what, and we handled the Comanche, and we can do the same thing with the Sioux. But as you got further to the east and people were further removed from the conflict, then there was much more sympathy for the Native tribes, although there was also a split depending upon the politics, because most newspapers declared themselves either Republican or Democrat, and Republican newspapers would support the Grant administration's peace policy, and oftentimes they would tend to be a little more sympathetic to the Native American side. But the one thing reading all these newspapers you would find is that there was never any real uniformity. People did disagree. There was a prominent Democratic newspaper in Chicago that was extremely sympathetic to the Native American side.
Give us some more perspective on that, the idea that you would pick up a newspaper and know what the sort of stated positions of that paper were, which didn't, I guess it didn't go so far as to have journalists leaving out facts or making up facts deliberately to support their cases, but they didn't necessarily feel that they had to be entirely objective.
No, I think they considered themselves independent. And all of these terms, objectivity, independence, are really hard to define.
Mm-hmm.
But one historian has said they were considered themselves independent, but that didn't mean they were neutral. For example, the Globe Democrat in St. Louis was a Republican newspaper, and like a lot of newspapers, it would list during the presidential election the Republican slate every day. The Louisville Courier-Journal would have the Democratic slate listed on its front page every day, and it was clear that they supported it. But for example, the editor of the Globe Democrat would say in his statement on the editorial page said, "We are a Republican newspaper, unashamedly so, because we believe in Republican principles. But we are going to criticize Republican politicians when we think they're doing the wrong thing." So that was how they looked at it that time. But it was very much above board, the positions of the press, what side they were on.
What was life like for a journalist or a war correspondent in the mid to late 19th century?
Well, they worked with the troops. They went with them in fighting the wars against the Native Americans. They took a lot of risks because they were not considered noncombatants by the Native Americans. At that time, few reporters had college degrees, so they weren't as educated as we think of them now. Journalism was considered more of a trade rather than a profession. I think a lot of men at that time who went into the war correspondent field did it out of a sense of adventure. A lot of these people had been war correspondents during the Civil War and kind of liked the adventure. And so also, I think they thought that this was a good way to get fame and recognition as well. For example, Mark Kellogg, the man who died with Custer's troops, had kind of an indifferent career as a reporter and had also run a grocery store. And he got to go on this campaign because his editor couldn't go. And so he thought this was his big break and he would be with Custer and he would be famous. And, of course, he was famous, and his name is on the memorial in the museum in Washington, D.C., but he left behind two young daughters.
And Kellogg was along, and can you give us talk about how Custer essentially split his forces at what turned out to be the exact wrong time to do so?
Yeah, that's one of the controversies about the battle, and Custer buffs and historians argue it to this day. As I had said earlier, there were three columns approaching the hostile tribes, and the main task of the army, or what they saw at that time, was merely to find the village, because the way the Native Americans fought, they would frequently split the village up into pieces as soon as they saw soldiers approaching, and so that was almost impossible to catch them unless you could sneak up on them and surround them. And they rarely fought pitched battles against the military. It was more raids and so forth. So everyone was concerned about first locating this village, and then once you locate it, make sure that you attack them right away so that they can't break up into smaller groups and escape. And Custer, out of all these commands, was the first one to find the village. And his scouts told him it was too big to handle, but Custer believed that the firepower of a modern army and the military tactics could prevail. And he used the same tactics on a battle in southwestern Oklahoma in the Ouachita earlier. Split the force into segments, make sure the village is surrounded, and then if the Native peoples are afraid that their women and children are going to be...
Let me jump in here really quick. You have to take a quick break. Sure. My guest is James E. Mueller, professor of journalism at UNT. His new book is Shooting Arrows and Slinging Mud.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with James E. Mueller, who is professor of journalism at the University of North Texas and author of the new book, Shooting Arrows and Slinging Mud, Custer, the Press, and the Little Bighorn. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org, by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or by sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Jim, before the break, you were telling us that Custer had used a similar strategy successfully, I gather, in Oklahoma previously, but it didn't work for him this one time.
Yeah, splitting the forces was a tactic he had used before, and the idea was to make sure that the native warriors didn't retreat or the village didn't split up into different segments. And so he had one company stay behind with the ammunition train, which was on slow-moving mules, and then he had one column go off to the side to make sure there weren't other villages or also to cut off an escape route. And then he took the remainder of the force and had Major Marcus Reno attack one end of the village, and then Custer rode off with his men to attack the other end of the village. And what happened was that instead of retreating or packing up the village, the Lakota and the Cheyenne swarmed out, stood their ground, overwhelmed Marcus Reno, forced him to retreat up to a hill, and then when they found out Custer was attacking the other end of the village, then they all left and swarmed that way, and they were outnumbering his force, you know, best guess, probably 2,000 to 3,000 warriors, and Custer had about 200 men with him, and so they were all completely overwhelmed.
So the one journalist who was along with Custer was killed, Mark Kellogg. So how did word begin to reach the outside world? And once other reporters came in to get that story, what was the process for them?
Well, the first news were military dispatches sent to Bismarck. And then another newspaper, I believe, in Utah. But the main one was from Bismarck. And the telegraph operators and editors immediately compiled short stories from the military dispatches, the military reports, and sent it off, Custer and all his men killed and that kind of thing. And then as more reports from the officers came in, they added more to it, interviewed people, and got a much bigger story. And then as soon as the story hit the East Coast, then the major newspapers in Chicago and New York and so forth sent correspondents out, and then they started sending back reports about the rest of the campaign and what would happen.
It's really interesting to think about the challenge for those correspondents because, as you well know, having done this sort of work yourself, it's hard enough to get the whole story when you're right there watching it, right? You can always miss something.
Yes.
It's doubly hard to go back in after the fact. And then having, for these individuals, having to sort of find the location where this took place and ascertain that particular individuals had actually been witnesses to this must have been really hard. And they were pretty transparent about the things they didn't get right away.
Yeah, they weren't able to, well, for one thing, interviews with Native Americans were pretty rare, although they did, when they could, they would talk to natives on the reservations who got reports from their relatives, or on occasion, Sitting Bull would send an emissary to the reservation to say he, you know, didn't want to fight anymore, that kind of thing. So they reported that stuff, but they really were handicapped that they could only get one side of the battle. And it was such a wide-ranging territory, and you had three columns of troops. So, yeah, it was really difficult for them to get their reports back. And they had a lot of hardship as well on the campaign because it wasn't going well. Mm-hmm. And so it was a difficult thing for the reporters at the time.
When they did have Native American sources, how important were they within stories, and what sort of weight were their accounts given?
Usually they would have a separate story about that. One emissary from Sitting Bull, again, his story was repeated in newspapers around the country when Sitting Bull kind of blamed the white people, the miners, for starting the war, and said that he really wanted peace. He didn't want to fight. He wanted to be left alone and that kind of thing. And so that was really reported largely without comment. But it was fairly rare. I mean, they would talk to other Native American leaders who would come in and or would allow reporters to go to the reservation and talk to them. But mostly they had to deal with the news with the Army and the government.
It's hard to imagine covering a war taking place on American soil among people that today are all considered U.S. citizens. It was a little bit different back then because can you talk a little bit about the way that, Native American tribes were thought of within the broader American culture and the debates that were ongoing about their right to territory or to any of the privileges afforded to other Americans?
Well, I think Americans at the time were a little bit confused. One of the more famous editorials, or one that I quote extensively, was one that was in the Chicago Times, and the headline was, "What is an Indian?" And the editor of the paper, Wilbur Story, who was quite sympathetic to Native views, said one of the main problems we have in the United States is we've never determined, are they citizens? Are they hostile? Should we treat them as foreign governments? Or should we treat them as quasi-American citizens? Or just how do we do it? But we need to find some clear-cut policy and decide. And the views ranged from, you know, an extreme of some people advocating extermination, but that was fairly rare, to people who said they should have complete citizenship rights and give them, you know, large pieces of territory and that kind of thing. And most people, I think, at least according to the newspapers, fell somewhere in between, saying, you know, obviously we can't exterminate these people, but they can't live the way they are hunting buffaloes. So the best thing we can do is to train them in, you know, Euro-American culture and teach them to be farmers and so forth. And so I think that's what the government and activists were trying to do, was to find some way to help them to adapt to what was going to be the dominant culture one way or the other.
What kinds of letters did people write back in to the editors responding to this coverage?
It was a variety. I think a lot of letters that they got were positive towards Custer, remembering him as a Civil War hero. Some letters, you know, were adamant about winning the war, punishing the Native tribes and so forth. But the New York Herald had a campaign where they were actively soliciting money to build a statue to Custer. Part of it was kind of a circulation promotion as well to get attention for the newspaper, but they were trying to raise money to build a statue, and so they printed all the letters they got where people would send in a little bit of money. And a lot of those letters were quite emotional and people sad about Custer's death. And there was one young woman who wrote in and sent 25 cents or some small amount and said that she so admired Custer, he was a man and he did what had to be done and that kind of thing. And a lot of people, both Confederate and Union veterans, would write in and say that they remembered his actions from the Civil War and he was a genuine hero and that kind of thing.
But the sort of the giant legend that Custer would become and the sort of mythology that grew up around him, it sounds like a lot of that actually happened outside of journalism itself and really sort of came from the popular culture.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the mainstream press did write the general facts of the battle, that, you know, Custer's body was found in the body of his troops and no one knew what happened. And so it was very mysterious and very heroic. And some of the accounts they wrote were indeed exaggerated. You know, Custer killed three Sioux warriors before he died with a sword. Well, the facts were he didn't take, none of the 7th Cavalry took swords with them, and no one knew how many people he killed, if any. But that stuff was really a minor part of the overall coverage. Most of it focused on what should we do now with this war, how should we prosecute it, and that kind of thing. And then very quickly, the working press moved on. That was another thing that kind of surprised me, because other historians have written that this battle played a key role in the 1876 presidential election. And, you know, one would think that, yes, a disaster like this, the press would be grilling the candidates. What are you going to do about this war? But that was hardly ever asked of the presidential candidates. They hardly ever talked about it. Instead, they talked about the economy, and they talked about Reconstruction. And those were the two main issues. You know, should we keep troops in the South or not? And how are we going to get people working again and that kind of thing? And after the battle occurred in late June, was first reported in July, and then by mid to late August, it was off the front pages and other things had taken over. And so it was largely put aside.
So news cycles may have been longer then, but they did indeed exist. And people would get fatigued, I suppose, by a particular issue.
Yeah, well, it's certainly the press did, and thought the public would be interested in more things closer to home, and certainly the election. Newspapers at that time covered politics much more extensively than they do today. I mean, they did have sports sections. There was baseball. The National League started playing in 1876, so many newspapers had sports news and stuff. But one of their main focuses always was politics. And in 1876, in the fall, within a month or so after the Little Bighorn, it was all about who's going to be elected president.
What can we make of the fact that it didn't last into the presidential election? Because it does seem like the kind of issue that would be important to people in choosing the person who would lead the country.
Well, I think you can compare it to today as well, where, we've had an ongoing war. We've had troops in Afghanistan for how many years? But the last presidential election, a lot of that was fought in terms of health care and the economy and so forth. And like today, the military in 1876 was all volunteer, and it was a small segment of the population, 25,000 active army in a population of, let's see if I've got this statistics right, maybe 50 million people, something like that. And today, we have a fairly large military, but if you compare it to the population as a whole, relatively few people have served or have relatives over there in comparison because we don't have a draft. And so if there's not a really intense level of military conflict, then there's less coverage. We had a lot of coverage in Iraq in the first months of the war, but when it kind of deteriorated into a guerrilla war, then it kind of moved a little bit off the front pages. And now, even though Americans are still being killed in Afghanistan, it's generally not a front page story.
So one interesting difference about media today is that regardless of what the evidence suggests, every media organization purports to be entirely objective and without political bias.
Yeah, today I think the theory of objectivity still stands, and you have few newspapers or other news organizations that will blatantly say they are either Republican or Democrat, even though readers can tell by their editorial page. But they won't, for example, run the Republican ticket on their front page like they did back in 1876. I think the press back in 1876 was much more transparent, and people knew where they stood. Now readers, viewers of TV have to kind of guess, well, I think this is kind of a liberal network or a liberal newspaper, and it's kind of understood Fox is conservative, NBC is liberal, but daily newspapers, I don't think in general really confess their political views.
Although, it's interesting with daily newspapers because there is the editorial section and then there is the sort of, well, we call it editorial news content, but the reported content. And they are different things. And a lot of people in the general public don't recognize that they're sort of run by different managers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's true. But I think, the choice of what stories are on the front page and headlines and so forth can indicate a certain level of bias or at least a certain opinion. What stories does a newspaper choose to focus on would kind of indicate an overall policy.
So these days, American journalists covering, say, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan want to tell the whole story and yet are often limited because they spend a lot of time with U.S. troops. They often communicate better with English-speaking Americans who might be in charge than with their adversaries. Can you talk about some parallels between these recent wars and the coverage and identification that took place during the Great Sioux War?
Well, I think, one of the quick parallels is that journalists today, as you said, have barriers talking to people who are opposing the United States because of language and merely access. And it's oftentimes dangerous also to talk to folks on the other side. And it was the same thing for reporters back in 1876. You know, it's really difficult to cover the Native American side of the story. And so reporters are relegated oftentimes to talking to the military and the government. And one of the differences, I think, is in some cases the way stories are framed. There have been other scholars who've identified that the way American soldiers are portrayed in the film, or not in the film, in the media since World War II has been increasingly as a victim. And some of the research that I've done of coverage of the Iraq War has also found a frame of American soldiers being portrayed as villains. And, for example, some of the most famous people to come out of the War on Terror have been Jessica Lynch and Pat Tillman. And Jessica Lynch was injured and then taken as a POW, but she didn't do anything where she won a Medal of Honor or something like that. She was more portrayed as a victim of her capture. And Pat Tillman was killed in a friendly fire accident. And so those are people who are generally remembered, but Medal of Honor winners and so forth don't seem to get as much play today. But if you look at the 1876 coverage of the military, it was much more framing the soldiers as heroes and doing heroic things and so forth.
This idea that they had these sort of superhuman qualities that might allow them to prevail.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My guest is James E. Mueller. He is professor of journalism at the University of North Texas and author of the new book, Shooting Arrows and Slinging Mud, Custer, the Press, and the Little Bighorn. You can join the conversation by sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, by emailing think@kera.org, or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372.
Support for KERA comes from you, our members, and from the Kimball Art Museum, presenting the Age of Picasso and Matisse, Modern Masters from the Art Institute of Chicago, now through February 16th. More at KimballArt.org.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James E. Mueller, professor of journalism at the University of North Texas and author of the new book, Shooting Arrows and Slinging Mud, Custer, the Press, and the Little Bighorn. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Jim, if people were willing to debate U.S. government policy toward Native Americans and the allocation of Native American lands, was there also a willingness within the press to criticize the tactics that Custer had employed on this very fateful day in mid-1876?
Oh, yes. There was a lot of controversy about what he had done. And a lot of that also fell along political lines, not all of it. Again, Custer was a Democrat, and at one time he considered running for Congress as a Democrat. He didn't do it, but he was friends with Democrats and politicians and publishers and so forth. And so Republican newspapers especially tended to blame him for attacking imprudently. And U.S. Grant, who was the president at the time, had also given an interview and said he considered it a waste of troops and kind of indicated Custer made a mistake. And Grant, being a Republican, Then a number of Democratic newspapers said, well, it's Grant's fault because he didn't send enough troops with Custer, because he had all these federal troops on duty reconstruction in the South. So part of it fell along those lines. But then also you had some crossover. The newspaper that I mentioned before, the Chicago Times, which was a solidly Democratic newspaper, at one time kind of took the party line and said Grant is to blame. But then after about a month of coverage, they admitted, you know, Custer was a great general and a great hero during the Civil War and so forth, but we do have to admit that it looks like he was the one who made a mistake and he should have used better judgment. Other folks, and sometimes Republicans, would say, no, you can't blame the commander on the field. A lot of Civil War veterans would say things like that. You know, it's really wrong to second-guess somebody if you weren't there. And that Custer had been successful his whole life, his whole military career, making these charges. And so he was just doing what we would expect a cavalryman to do in contact with the enemy: charge, don't let them get away. And so he did what he was supposed to do. But there was a really vigorous debate, which carries on to this day, whether Custer used poor judgment or used standard tactics.
Well, and it does sound like the kind of, and I don't want to call it Monday morning quarterbacking, because these debates are important and they're important for our society. But the debates we continue to have over the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the what was called the War on Terror, I mean, it just seems there's so much more of it now, and it's sort of endless, and it comes from multiple sources. I mean, it sounds as if once the main front page coverage of Custer's last stand was over, then the story sort of calcified into something else, and Custer became, an untarnishable hero for many people.
For a while, at least until probably the 1920s, when there was a revisionist period in American history where a lot of scholars looked at many heroes, including Custer, and there was a famous book called Glory Hunter that really portrayed Custer as a egomaniac. But up until that time, for about 50 years, he was generally considered a great American hero. A lot of that had to do with his wife, Libby Custer, who was also an author and wrote three books about his life and really responded to any kind of criticism. And there was also the feeling, I think, within the military, that kind of a closed group, that we're not going to let too much criticism of one of our own out. Mm-hmm. But there was a court of inquiry in 1879 as to whether Marcus Reno had made mistakes in the Battle of Little Big Horn, because some people scapegoated him for not carrying through the initial attack when Custer ordered him. So there was some debate back and forth, but yeah, Custer was usually considered a hero up until the 1920s, and then his reputation has gone up and down. With the movie Little Big Man in 1970, I think his reputation took a nosedive. And probably for a lot of people today, when they think of Custer, they think of a huge mistake or a symbol of failure.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to David in Irving. Hi, David.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Okay. Well, I've got some comments, because when I heard about the Custer, one of the first jobs I had, I graduated from McGill School of Journalism, and was to work in the Crow Indian Reservation in Lodge Grass, Montana. Mm. Well, I'm a senior citizen now, so that was a long time ago, and it was very interesting because I walked those grounds that he's talking about. I don't know whether he's a historian. I didn't catch the beginning of the show, but one of the things that we've missed, or at least so far in the conversation, is that whether he's a hero or not, he really made a big mistake, because they had the teepees set up, and you could more or less tell how many Indians there were by the teepees. But what they totally missed, which was a mistake that they made, was the braves, the young warriors, they didn't have teepees. They were single, and they were sleeping under the trees and the bushes and different places like that. And so they missed the whole number of people, the fighters, the warriors.
What was that? Was that reported at the time? Maybe that was the reason why there had been a miscalculation of how many forces the American troops would be up against.
Yeah, I mean, he had what we would call faulty intelligence today. I mean, the estimates from the Indian agencies were that they would have X number of roamers or hostiles or whatever term you would use. And it turned out they had a lot more because people kept leaving all summer long, more and more. And it was kind of unusual and unexpected. But one of the reasons why a lot of people blame Custer was because his scouts at the time, and he had Crow and Arikara scouts warning him, this is a huge village. Several of the scouts said, you know, this is the largest village we've ever seen. And one of his scouts bluntly told him, if we go down here, we're all going to go home a road we do not know, you know. And Custer, you know, had that information, but he still believed, as one scout said, you know, we'll be fighting here for 3 days or something like that if we go down there. And Custer said, nah, we can get through them in one day. And I think Custer's position was that he had a modern army. He had tactics where everybody fought together. He'd used his tactics before, and so he really wasn't afraid of the size of the village. It didn't really matter. What mattered was catch them before they can split up into small groups, because his mistake was he anticipated they would run, but they did not run. Sitting Bull had a vision before the battle that they should stay and fight, that they would have a great victory, and everyone in the village was convinced that they could withstand anything. And so it was a really combination of unusual factors.
There were, like, conflicting accounts of the fate of Sitting Bull after the battle, weren't there?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, a lot of newspapers reported that Sitting Bull had been killed, that Crazy Horse had been killed, and so forth. But Sitting Bull actually didn't participate in combat. He was, I think he was about 60 years old, and his role was more of a spiritual advisor, and he stayed in the village organizing kind of a last-ditch defense, getting the women and children together and providing a spiritual presence. So he wasn't even really a participant in the battle, an active combat participant, and he wasn't killed. But yeah, some of the initial reports were mistaken.
How did they make corrections, newspapers back then? Was it the same sort of process as today?
No, they didn't necessarily have a corrections page, but they would just run a new story. And sometimes they would say something we reported earlier turned out to be wrong. And then oftentimes they would report things and say, okay, we've heard that Sitting Bull is dead, but we have no way to confirm it, but this is what we heard. And so they would just lay it out there as rumor, and they actively sought rumor. And one of the phrases from Wilbur's story, what he directed his correspondence during the Civil War was, send all the news you can. If you can't send news, send rumors. But they would identify it almost always as rumors, and so people could take it with a grain of salt.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Bill on the line now in Arlington. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I've been hearing bits and pieces of the story, but one of the things I wanted to take notice of is we're talking about the mistakes Custer made, some of the support things logistically of that battle, but I think we're missing something here in the overall policy of either the United States government, the president, or the Department of War, or whoever it was in Washington making these decisions. But I believe that according to what they were doing, they were absolutely trying to annihilate, kill, or exterminate as many Indians as they could. And I say that based on reading and kind of observing some things, especially on a trip up the Black Hills and the Wounded Knee. I believe Custer was in there to attack the village and to kill as many as he could. And there were, of course, families there and children. And then years later at Wounded Knee, and the stories that came out of that event, the soldiers were trying to clarify if they were involved in Custer's Little Bighorn, and that was a massacre. And as a result, all those Indians that were killed, 20 Congressional Medals of Honor were given to those soldiers who sat there and blew away those Indians.
Well, Bill, I'm very glad you called and made that point. Was this something that people made a distinction about in 1876, that the difference between people who are warriors and innocent women and children and elderly people.
Yes, they did make that distinction, at least within the professional army. But, you know, you have to also recognize there were individuals and individual reactions to, you know, some people were extreme in their views, some were not. But, you know, the evidence that they were not there to kill everyone was that they routinely took prisoners. They took prisoners from the villages. Now, did they kill civilians? Yes, they killed civilians, but their argument was that often the civilians, young boys, women, would also pick up weapons and fight back. And so in an active firefight, it's hard to tell who is who. But definitely, you know, women and children were killed, and Wounded Knee was a separate episode, which was pretty horrific. But Custer at the Battle of the Ouachita took a number of prisoners. There's some conjecture that his attack on the other end of the village, his direct command, he hoped to take prisoners and then force the village to surrender, that was another tactic. If you capture the civilians, then the warriors will lay down their weapons. So, yes, it was brutal, but also you need to put it in context of the Civil War as well, where a lot of these soldiers were veterans of that and had seen a lot of brutal behavior in the Civil War, where civilian populations were targeted in raids. And William Tecumseh Sherman famously said, "War is cruelty and you cannot refine it," when he basically forced every person out of the city of Atlanta and turned it into a military headquarters and just forced the people into the surrounding countryside without any place to go. And so, yes, they fought in brutal terms, but it was the way they had been fighting for a number of years.
You mentioned earlier that few journalists back in the 19th century had college educations. That is something that most have today, but not all. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how the language of journalism has changed over time?
Well, they used much more active prose. They used a lot of literary allusions to Shakespeare or plays or other popular culture and so forth. You know, they would compare Custer to Sir Walter Raleigh, you know, the Knights of the Round Table and that kind of stuff. A lot of stuff that you don't really, I don't think you see that kind of parallel, certainly not in Associated Press stories and mm-hmm. so forth. And the inverted pyramid wasn't quite into vogue, where you would just kind of lay out the facts of the story first. Instead, a lot of times stories were written as more of a story or as a narrative. And then also, a lot of times the reporters would use the first person. And it was pretty interesting to read as well when they would describe their own hardships on the campaign. One reporter writing about how he was fantasizing about going back to New York and eating dinner at Delmonico's and that kind of stuff and tired of the Army hardtack.
It does sort of bring the stories alive. And, I mean, it seems odd to us today, but it also seems pretty engaging in its own way.
Oh, yeah, it very much was. And one reporter from Chicago detailed his trip by train out to the front and talked about how nervous he was getting and how, you know, people were kidding him about he was going to get scalped and that kind of stuff, and he got his hair cut close and that kind of stuff. And one train conductor called him Standing Bull.
James E. Mueller is professor of journalism at the University of North Texas and author of Shooting Arrows and Slinging Mud, Custer, the Press, and the Little Bighorn. Jim, thank you so much for making time for us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.